All right, we are in Numbers. We're ready for chapter 5 through 7 in our study tonight. And this is where we are in our outline. This is Baxter's outline of dealing with the old generation, and we're ready for the second subsection of the instructing. We saw the numbering in chapters 1 to 4, and starting in chapter 5 is the instructing, and then we'll see the journeying. They're ready to take off and leave from Sinai. That'll get a little more exciting, I suppose, as we get to that point and watch them leave. And then we'll see them in that transition era in the wilderness. As per Wiersbe's outline, we're in the canceled section, chapters 5 to 10, as he puts it. And so this has to do with instruction. So all of these chapters relate somehow to some instructions that are needed before they leave Sinai. We'll talk about that leaving and the significance of that a little bit later, but not tonight. One writer has suggested that these chapters could be chapters 5 through 9. We're not going that far tonight, but chapters 5 through 9, this instructing section, or if you want to encompass chapter 10 as per this outline, that these may be or could be the spiritual ordering of the camp, just as chapters 1 to 4 had to do with the physical ordering of the camp. That's a pretty good point. We saw in chapters 1 and 2, JP dealt with that while I was away, but the structure and the ordering of this tribe is here, this tribe is there, this tribe is over there, this tribe is over here, the Levites are here, this family of the Levites is here, this family of the Levites is over there. And so here is the physical ordering. And so this very well may be focusing on the spiritual ordering of the children of Israel in the camp. So be that as it may, let's get underway and review where we've been. Chapter 1, what was it about? All right, that was the first census. This is the book of Numbers, and it has to do with numbering the children of Israel. So that was the first census. Chapter 2, separation by the camps that we just talked about. Which tribe was camped where on which side of the tabernacle? Chapter 3, last time. Yeah, the Levites were chosen and they are numbered. And so we have the numbering of the Levites, how many there were, the significance of that. And then chapter 4 focused on something we need to know tonight, and that is the duties of these Levites. And so there were three divisions of the Levites. And we'll talk about those three divisions in a little bit in chapter 7 and the significance of where they were and what they were to do. But those are important. All right, let's go to question number 1 for tonight. What's chapter 5 about? All right, yes, we have the matter in chapter 5 of the unclean persons, restitution, and the test for the unfaithful wife. And in the first two of those is just the execution of laws that have already been given. No new law is given here with reference to that. Now, the test is something new for us, and so we'll get to that here in a moment. Chapter 6, what's it about? Yeah, the Nazarite vow. And right at the end is the priestly blessing. This is how, kind of a formula by which the priest would bless. And we'll talk about the significance of that. It's a very familiar phraseology that's used there. And then chapter 7, same question, number 1. All right, the offerings from the leaders from each tribe and what they brought and who it went to and what they were. And so it's one of those, it's a long chapter, 89 chapters, and much of it is repetitious. There must be some significance to that. And we'll see what all that is here in just a moment. All right, here's a summary of the three chapters that you have just given to me, and that is chapter 5 dealing with unclean persons and restitution and the test for the unfaithful wife. These are chapters dealing with miscellaneous things that don't necessarily one float into the next one. In other words, there doesn't seem to be a lot of connection between chapter 5 and chapter 6 and chapter 6 and chapter 7. Does that make sense? Where some chapters, one flows into the next one and that flows into the next one. This is miscellaneous type things. concerning some instruction of ordering themselves spiritually here on the before they take off from the camp. Now we'll get some time frame. The time frame is not given for chapters 5 and 6, but there is some time frame given with reference to chapter 7. We'll flag that when we get there. All right, let's talk about chapter 5 now. Question number 2, what was to be done with an unclean person? They were to be put out of the camp, according to the text, and we'll get to that here in a second. All right, let's talk about the unclean person and what we have here in verses 1 to 4. Three things happen here. First of all, is this unclean person. Now, you might make a marginal note if you're so disposed to do that kind of thing. Leviticus 13, verses 45 and 46 is where the law was given. You might turn back there just briefly. We're not going to spend much time there, but Leviticus chapter 13, verses 45 and 46. This is where the leper, though he was not the only one that was unclean, this is a sampling of that, that if he a leper on whom a sore of his clothes was to run through the streets hollering, unclean, unclean, and he was unclean, and he shall be unclean, and he is unclean, and he shall dwell alone in his habitation outside the camp. All right, there was the law, or at least part of that law. There was more to it than that. And what we have here is the execution of that, or the enforcement of that law. So here as things are getting structured and in order, I'm not going to spend much time here with verses 1 to 4, that they were to find every leper and everyone that had a discharge and everyone that was defiled by a dead body. Those were various unclean people. And they were, you should put both male and female outside the camp. And so that's just basically the execution. So they look around and find out here is the leper, and they're to put outside the camp. Here is someone who'd been defiled. They're to be put out of the camp. And here is one over here that has a bodily discharge. They're to be put out of the camp. And other regulations with reference to that. So we're going to leave that alone and move on to restitution. On the section of restitution, verses 5 through 10, if you're so disposed to mark, the law was given in Leviticus 6, verses 1 through 7. And that is, when something was taken and correction was made and confession was made, there was to be restitution. So again, we have the execution or the enforcement of that law. So speak to the children of Israel, verse 6. They've committed a sin against another and that person is guilty. They make confession and then make restitution. What are they to do in restitution? Verse 7. Yeah, give back and add a fifth, which is 20%. So 20% more of the value of whatever that may be. But if a man has no kinsman to whom the restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest. Now that's interesting. What do you make of that? In other words, you've stolen from a man, and you are to pay back that once you, maybe some time has passed, you decide you want to correct that, and so you make confession and acknowledge I did wrong, and I want to pay it back, and he's dead. And so you still are to pay something back, and you carry it to the priest, and it's for the priest. All right, good point. Yeah, this was a sin against the Lord. This was not just a sin against him. You sinned against the Lord when you sinned against your brother. And here's something I learned from that. Restitution is as much for the offender as it is for the offended. And so if I've stole from you, if we were in Old Testament times, and I've stole from you, I need to make restitution as much for me as to make it right for you. Does that make sense? And again, it gets, as pointed out, it's against the Lord. So I'll learn another practical lesson, and you may have some others listed at question number 5. Another practical lesson is concerning restitution, that we take responsibility for our own actions. Rather than blame it on society, they were to take responsibility for their actions. All right, any other questions on verses 1 through 10? Verse 9, to continue that thought, if there is no kinsman, near kinsman, to receive the restitution, then the offering is for the priest, and it shall be his, according to verse 9, and every man's holy thing shall be his. Whatever man gives to the priest shall be his. And so that was a blessing for the priest. He takes that and it's his. Make sense? All right, no new ground so far. So let's talk about this test for an unfaithful wife, verses 11 to 31. This is new material for us. I don't mean you haven't studied this before in Numbers. You've been through that before. But what I'm saying, going through the Old Testament, starting back with Genesis as we did at the first of the year, this is new ground for us. We haven't seen this. We've seen passages dealing with adultery, the sin of adultery, etc. Let's flag a passage here for what it's worth to us. Leviticus 20, we've already come through that. Leviticus 20 and 10 said that when a man commits adultery with a woman, I'm paraphrasing, this is not a quotation, a man commits adultery with a woman, both him and her were to be stoned to death. In other words, when it's acknowledged or it's obvious or there were witnesses, it's obvious this man and this woman have committed adultery, they both were to be stoned to death. That was God's view of adultery. So what we have here, I'm going to follow this outline here, in 11 to 14 is the circumstance under which there may be a question. What is that circumstance? Man becomes suspicious that perhaps his wife has committed adultery. Apparently, there are no witnesses. She is denying that because if she's acknowledging that, there's no need for a test. So she's denying that she's committed adultery, but he's suspicious of that. Some speculate maybe she's with child and she's showing signs that she is pregnant, and so consequently he's thinking, you've been unfaithful to me. Is that the case? We're not told here. But there's something makes him suspicious of that. Maybe the time that she's spending with someone else. But whatever the case, we're not told exactly what prompted that. We'll get to that a little bit. Maybe there's some speculation about that beginning at verse 21 down through verse 29. We'll get to all that later. But in verses 11 to 14, the circumstance is that it's hidden from the eyes of her husband. That is, if she has done something, or at least he thinks she has, it's hidden from his eyes, and she's defiled herself, there's no witness, and no one has caught her. And if the spirit of jealousy comes upon him, and that spirit of jealousy comes to the point that although she has not defiled herself, in other words, I think the text is presenting, he's jealous, and it may be she has committed adultery, or it may be that she has not committed adultery. He's suspicious, he doesn't have any proof of that. Then what does he do, verse 15? Yeah, he brings her to the priest. Now notice the wording of verse 15. He brings her to the priest and brings an offering required for her, one-tenth of an ephah of barley meal, and he shall pour no oil on it, no frankincense on it, because it is a grain offering of jealousy. Now notice the description now, an offering of remembering for bringing iniquity to remembrance. In other words, the whole ordeal here and this offering is trying to discover. We would call that in court a discovery. They're trying to discover the evidence. Has she been unfaithful to him? And God's going to reveal that. That's the bottom line. There was no secret test. It's not a medical test that she's put through. And the doctor said, yes, she's been unfaithful, and here's the DNA and da-da-da-da-da. None of that. God's going to reveal that. God had a way for doing that. Now you need to remember, let me stop and footnote. You need to remember Numbers 5, because Numbers 5 will help us a little bit, not a whole lot, but just a little bit in our interpretation of Deuteronomy 24 a little bit later. What was that uncleanness? Well, it wasn't suspicion of her unfaithfulness. How do I know? Because God had a test for that. That wasn't dealt with in Deuteronomy 24. So I can eliminate a lot of things of what that uncleanness was. And we'll get to that in Deuteronomy 24. So we'll save all of that. But this iniquity of remembrance, forgot which translation it was, maybe New Century, one of them, in essence, says something like, to find out whether she's guilty or not. And that's what this remembrance is. Now, beginning at verse 16 through 24, what is the priest going to do now? Going to take this offering and put it in her hands, and then he gets some water, dust from the floor of the tabernacle, and he puts that in the water. And then notice at verse 18, he shall stand before the woman and uncover the woman's head. That was a sign of shame for her to uncover her head. And so she is standing before the priest, being shamed, perhaps. We're going to see if she needs to be shamed or not. But this is the charge, or even for the test. My husband is suspicious that I'm guilty. There is some shame to be connected with that. And so she uncovers her head, and he puts the offering in her hand. And then what? Yeah, look at verse 19. He shall put her under an oath, and if a man has lain with you, in other words, if you've been unfaithful, or if you've not gone astray to uncleanness, while under your husband's authority. Now, if you flag that at verse 19, you might do that again at verse 20 and again at verse 29, when under the husband's authority. That does suggest she's under his leadership, but I don't think that's the major thrust here. There are other passages that talk about the husband having authority and rule over the wife, but I think it's while she's committed to him. I think that's the idea. While she's committed to him, she was submissive to him, supposed to be submissive to him, and be committed to this relationship. And if you have gone astray, then be free from the, if you were not, you have not been unfaithful, then you're free from the curse of this bitter water. But if you've gone astray while under your husband's authority, now what? Been with some other man. Verse 21. All right, very good. Look at verse 21. That God will put a curse on you and an oath among your people that'll make your thigh rot and your belly swell. What does that mean? We'll come to that in a minute. I'm going to come back. I want to get ahead to verse 22 and stop at the end of verse 22 for a moment. Now, what does she do when, and may this water go down into your belly and your belly swell and your thigh rot? And then the woman would say, so be it, amen. In other words, she just took a vow. I'm willing to take the test. I am not guilty. I haven't done this. And so I'm willing to drink the water. And if I have been unfaithful, this is going to make my belly swell and my thigh rot. And if not, then I am innocent, as I said I was. So be it. Amen. Now let's talk about this phrase at verse 22, or verse 21, the thigh rot in your belly swell. Literally, the thigh rotting is not, don't get the picture that the thigh is going to decay like it has a disease and it's just going to rot. That's not the idea. The literal rendering of that, in fact, your footnote may say fall or fall away. And it alludes to the fact that it probably means rendering her sterile. And we'll give you contextual evidence of that in a moment. We'll come to that in just a second. But now, some think it has reference to perhaps a miscarriage. Is that? I'm not sure about that, but it has something to do with the fact that I'm convinced that she's not going to be able to have children beyond this. She's going to be sterile. Evidence of that, the contrast at verse 28. We'll get to that in a second. The New Revised Standard Version. Now, this is a little bit crude language, but it is the rendering of the New Revised Standard Version. That instead of saying your thigh rot and your belly swell, it'll make your uterus drop and the womb discharge. That's a miscarriage. That's what that's saying. Now, is that a correct translation? I don't know for sure. The New Century said your body will be unable to give birth to another baby. Now, that's more of a paraphrase, the New Century quite often is. And that's why I quote from it, not as a good translation, but as a good summary. It may have reference to miscarriage, or it may have reference she's not going to be able to have children. Now, why do I think it may have reference to her being sterile? Let's get ahead of ourselves. If she is innocent, then she'll be free and may conceive children. Isn't that interesting? If she's innocent, she will be able to conceive. If she's guilty, her thigh will rot and her belly swell. That sounds like you'll be able to have children, you won't be able to have children. Am I making sense? I'm letting the context define that for me, more than the commentators. You looked as confused as I was before I started. I'm trying to let the context define that for me. Now, you may say, I think it literally means that her belly will swell. Some have argued that it has to do with her belly swelling in the sense that she's going to swell because she's pregnant. Well, she's going to do that whether she drinks the water or not. That's going to happen. So I don't think it has reference that by drinking this water, her belly's going to swell because she's pregnant. Because that's going to happen one way or the other. But there's something about belly swelling, and there's going to be a problem that is going to be the opposite of verse 28. Now, verse 23, before she drinks that, he writes the curse in a book. And what does he do with the curse? He's going to... Yeah, that has to be symbolic. But he writes it down and then scrapes it off into the water. There's really nothing in the water that's going to make her thigh rot. Any more than there was something in the water when Naaman was healed. God's doing that. He's just doing at the command of God. So here is water that has the dust of the floor of the tabernacle in it. And then before she drinks it, here's the curse that has been written down. And he rakes that off into the water for her to drink. One has said she eats her words now. You ever been told that somebody's going to eat their words? She said, I'm not guilty, basically. She's saying, I have not done this. And she's going to eat those words. They may be sweet to eat if she's innocent, but they're going to be bitter to eat if she's guilty. Does that make sense? She's going to eat that. So she does all of that. Now what? Verses 24 to 29. The priest then takes the offering after she drinks that, and he takes the offering and waves it before the Lord. And then they wait to see the results of that. But if the woman has not, down to verse 28 now, has not defiled herself and is clean, she shall be free and able to conceive children. This is the law of jealousy while under her husband's authority, and she goes astray or defiles herself. Now notice at verse 31, what do you learn before we leave that? Yeah, he's free from the iniquity. The man shall be free from the iniquity, but the woman shall bear her guilt. In other words, if she's guilty. So does that make sense, what's going on here? He's become ragingly jealous and needs to find out. And so he takes his wife before the priest. He makes this offering and make the determination. And through this process, there is that test to find out, has she been unfaithful or not? Think of the position she would be in when he brings her before him and she's lying. That she's about to tell something that is going to mean she won't be able to bear children again. She won't have any more children after this. Yes, ma'am. My answer to that is I'm not sure. Because this text doesn't say. The only implication I'm thinking of is by the time we get to Matthew 1, the enforcement or the binding force of the being betrothed was nearly equal to, though not completely equal to, being married. And perhaps so, is all I know to say. All right, we want to spend a little time on that. Now that'll help you a little bit. All right. Now let's talk about the Nazirite vow and the priestly blessing. The priestly blessing doesn't take much time to work through. But let's talk about this Nazirite vow. This is one of those passages like Numbers or Leviticus 16, for example. And I'm not saying they're parallel. What I'm saying is, you'll remember when we come to the Day of Atonement. Oh, yeah, Leviticus 16 is that passage. We're going to come again and again and talk about perhaps this is a Nazarite vow. We'll come to a phrase or somewhere in the Old Testament. This may have reference to the Nazarite vow. And so what is the Nazarite vow? This is your go-to source. Make sense? This is your reference. So this is new material for us, starting with Genesis. We haven't seen anything about this before. Let's see what this is all about. This is not to be confused, and often the spelling, if you see somebody talking about the Nazarite vow, I've been guilty of this, to spell it as N-A-Z-A-R, as if it's one from connected somehow with Nazareth, has nothing to do with Nazareth, the city of Nazareth, has no connection at all, none, period. So that's a misspelling of that. I've noticed on some old notes that I had spelled it wrong. It's Nazarite vow, N-A-Z-I-R-I-T-E. And it has to do, the word for Nazarite has to do with vow. It just simply means a vow. It has nothing to do with a city. It has to do with a vow of devotion. Now, so you choose to be a Nazarite. Now we're going to see three things, the requirements, what to do if you're defiled, and then what to do when the days are fulfilled. Let's talk a little bit about it before we get into all of that. This was a voluntary vow of holiness. There was nothing here or in any other text that demanded one take the Nazarite vow. If so, why do we not have more examples of those who did? We have some examples of some men. We don't know of an example of any woman that did. I'm not saying they didn't, we're just not told that. So the examples we have is that of Samson in Judges 13, verses 4 and 5, Samuel in 1 Samuel 1 and verse 11, and John the Baptist in Luke chapter 1 and verse 15. Perhaps others, but we know of those three. We have no record of a woman. Again, I'm not saying they didn't. There may have been more women than men. I'm just saying we don't have a record of it. If so, where is the record? So this was a voluntary vow of holiness for a period of time. For how long? This text doesn't say. There's a reason why this text doesn't say. If this is a, finish my sentence, if this is a voluntary vow, yeah, there's no demand for how long, so you would be the one to decide how long. The Mishnah was a collection of the Jewish laws and traditions. The Mishnah suggested, according to the ISBE, that some would make this vow for 30 days, some for 60, and some went as long as 100 days. That would be more extreme. So by that, you decide, I want to dedicate my life to the Lord for a period of time, for 30 days. Then here are the requirements if you're going to do that. Does that make sense? So God did have requirements, but not that you do it, but if you did, this is the requirements to follow. Let me give you a parallel. I'm not saying this is a Nazarite vow, not at all, but this is very similar. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 to 5, the husband and wife are not to defraud each other of that intimate relationship, except be for a season, some period of time that they've agreed upon, that they devote themselves to prayer and fasting. Sounds similar? Here's a period of devotion. Here is a period of dedication. We're going to devote ourselves to fasting and prayer, so we're going to abstain from any intimate relationship during this time so that we dedicate ourselves for this agreed time, whatever time that may be. Does that make sense? You say, are you saying this is the Nazarite vow? Not at all. I'm just saying here is a concept of devoting yourself for an agreed time that God did not require, but you set the time yourself. Does that make sense? But in 1 Corinthians 7, God set some regulations on it, didn't he? Even in New Testament time. If you say, well, me and my wife or me and my husband are going to do that as per 1 Corinthians 7, okay, if you're going to do that, pay attention to the requirements of the text. Because God does set some regulations on that. Same thing here. Does that make sense? All right, let's work through this. We're not going to spend much time with chapter 7 for obvious reasons. We're going to get to that here in a minute. So if you do that, let's see what happens. What were the requirements? Verses 3 and 3 through 8. All right, he is to abstain from drink, but really it involved more than drink. He was not to even have anything that came from the vine. So he couldn't eat grapes or raisins. He abstains from that. He's abstaining from, some suggest that means he's abstaining from pleasure. He's abstaining from anything that he may desire, such as the grapes. Others have suggested that he needs clarity of mind. I'm not so much interested in the reason. God said he's going to abstain from that. Secondly, what's he to do? Not cut his hair. Now notice in verse 5, he calls this in the days of the vow of his separation. So some have suggested, and maybe this is the case, that by not cutting his hair, he is symbolizing and demonstrating, I'm separated and different. Other people are cutting their hair, but I'm not cutting mine. So it may be for 30 days. It may be for 100 days. It may be for 70 days. However many days he's decided. He doesn't cut his hair. And it's going to be obvious. Something's different about him. He's taken the Nazarite vow. He hasn't taken a drop of a grape. He hasn't eaten a raisin. And he hadn't cut his hair. He's separated. It's a symbol of his being holy. Third thing he's not to do. Not to be near a dead body, even if, verse 7, it's family. So God took devotion and separation very seriously, that there was not even an exception that if your daddy or your mama died. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Family did not come between this vow. You didn't even have to make the vow, but in that you made the vow and you're going to take this Nazarite vow, family is not to come between you and your God. Powerful. All right. Now then, what do you do if he becomes defiled? All right. He shaves his head to show, now there's been a violation of this, even though it was accidental, and he's to make this offering of two turtle doves, take it to the priest, etc. But notice in verse 12, what does it do to his days of, let's say he's vowed to go for 60 days. He's 40 days in, and he comes in contact with the dead. What about those 40 days he's already got under his belt? Boy, done and it finished and over. In other words, if he wants to go for 60 days, he needs to start over. Yeah, that's what he's going to have to do. Now, beginning at verse 13, what's to be done when his days are fulfilled? Let's go again, 60 days and or 30 days, whatever it may be, and those days are over and his vow has come to an end. He's accomplished what he wanted. Now what does he do? Bring an offering to the Lord. Look at verse 14. You might underline, the one male, the one ewe lamb, the one ram, and a basket of unleavened bread. And then there's also a drink offering. We haven't said much about a drink offering. If you want to flag a passage that deals with that, Exodus 29 and verse 40 dealt with that drink offering. A pouring out of wine would be one form of the drink offering. Then verse 18, what was to be done? So he makes his offerings to the Lord. He's let his hair grow. So now he shaves his head, and then he gives a wave offering, verse 18b through verse 21. And the wave offering then becomes holy for the priest. In other words, the priest takes that. That's the law of the Nazarite vow. And notice he calls this the law of his separation. That's what it's all about. That he's separating himself, devoting himself for some special purpose to the Lord. It may be prayer. It might have been for a particular service. But he's making himself holy to the Lord for that period of time. Is there anything wrong with anyone doing something similar today? 1 Corinthians 7 implies that would be fine. All right. Now let's talk about what this blessing is right here at the end of chapter 6. What is it? Tell Aaron and his sons, they're the high priest. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, this is how Aaron will bless the people. And when he's gone, then his sons. And when they're gone, their sons. Make sense? So God didn't just say, bless them, this is how I want you to do that. This is the kind of thing I want you to say to them in blessing them. So what does that involve? Well, the Lord bless you and the Lord keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you. That's the opposite of the Lord turning his face. There are numerous references in the Bible of God turning his face from Israel. In other words, his favor is not there. So may the Lord bless you. May the Lord's favor be with you. May the Lord's grace be with you. And may God's countenance be with you. God be with you wherever you go, and you will have peace. In other words, this is a reminder. You go with the Lord, and the Lord will go with you. You follow the Lord, and the Lord will bless you. You turn to the Lord, and the Lord's face will follow you. But you don't, then none of that will be true. Well, they're going to have troubles, as we're going to see when they get out in the wilderness. We're at Numbers, starting in chapter 7, but chapter 16, the earth is going to be swallowing some. So that didn't last too long, did it? All right, let's go to chapter 7. Chapter 7, let's talk about the offerings of the leaders. This is the longest chapter, and so we've only got about 7 minutes, and I think we can do it in 7 minutes, because much of the chapter is repetitious. This tribe offered, and it's the same offering that the tribe did before. And so we have 12 times repeated the same thing. Not that it's unimportant, but it won't take us long to comprehend that. 10 to 88 is going to be that section. Let's talk about these carts and the oxen for the Levites. Let's flag a time here. When Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, we think that's been a good while back, like in Exodus 40. Which seems like a good while back because we've come through Leviticus, but the clock wouldn't just keep churning all this time. So we're back at the time frame of Exodus 40. Does that make sense? And so at the time the tabernacle was erected in Exodus 40 and verse 17, we're at that point here. Does that make sense? So that now that it has been erected, it's all been set up, the priestly service has been put in place that we've been discussing already. Now then, the children of Israel bring offerings for the priest, for the Levites. So the first thing they bring, verse 3, is what? Six carts and 12 oxen. Basically, an oxen for every tribe and one cart, one covered cart, one covered wagon for every two tribes. And so here's how they're scattered out. Starting at verse 7. Two carts and four oxen were given to the family of... Now remember, these are the three families of the Levites that camped around the tabernacle we talked about last time. So of Gershon, two carts and four oxen were given. Now we're not told here, so I'll give the references here for you. We saw in Numbers 3 and Numbers 4, their job was transporting the tent, the covering and the screens and the hangings. So all that had to be folded up and transported, and they need carts. So they needed two carts and four oxen. Does that make sense? So there, as they transport, they're going to load that up on those two carts. All right, now notice at verse 8, four carts and eight oxen were given to the family of Merari. Now what was their job? Well, we're not told here, but in Numbers 3, Numbers 4, their job was transporting the boards and the pillars and the bars and the sockets, etc. Make sense? So basically all the cloth material and all the wood material separated. And so there's more that's needed for these four carts. So they needed four carts and eight oxen that they're going to use to transport. So when they get ready to move from place to place, these carts and these oxen are going to be used. Make sense? Now, how much was given to the sons of Kohath? None. No ox and no carts. Why? Yes. Their job was transporting the ark, lampstand, the table, and altars, etc., that had the staves or the poles, and so they bore that on their shoulders. So let's flag verse 9. None was given because their service of the holy things which they carried on their shoulders. The others are carrying this with the carts. they carry those on their shoulders. Make sense? So they don't need an ox, they don't need a cart. Isn't it interesting? We get a little bit later, and they try to transport the ark on an ox cart. If they'd have known their Old Testament history, they'd have known that wasn't designed for that. They didn't know that too well, or forgot it. All right. Now then, the clock is running, so let's move now to the next section, the offerings from each tribe, verses 10 to 88. So if you're so disposed to mark, we'll flag which these were divided up over 12 days, the 12 tribes. And so let's first of all get what each tribe brought. Let's flag the first day. At verse 12, the first day, it was the tribe of Judah. All right. Here's what they brought. One silver platter of 130 shekels in weight, full of fine flour. One bowl, silver bowl, 70 shekels in weight, full of fine flour. One golden pan, 10 shekels in weight, full of incense. One young bull, one ram, one male lamb in the first year. One kid goat, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, and five male lambs. That was brought on the first day by Judah. All right. Now let's go down to the second day, verse 18. On the second day, it was the tribe of Issachar. What'd they bring? Same thing. Repeat that order right there. Repeat the same stuff. All right. Now let's go to the third day, found at verse 24. You see why we're going through this chapter quickly? For two reasons. We can do it, and we're out of time. Who's on the third day? Zebulun. Fourth day, verse 30, is Reuben. Fifth day is Simeon, verse 36. Somebody flag which verse is the sixth day. My pages are stuck together. 42. Sixth day is Gad. Next one is 48. The seventh day, Ephraim. And then you have on the eighth day, verse 54, is ninth day, verse 60, Benjamin. And the 10th day, verse 66. 11th day, verse 72. And the 12th day, verse 78, Naphtali. And what did each tribe bring? First day, this is what that tribe brought. The next day, this is what they brought. The next day, this is what they brought. Until 12 days later, we have now the summary. So if you want to mark off verses 84 to 88, that's basically the grand total. Here's the summary of all that was brought. Sounds like a lot of stuff. But we've got a lot of people, don't we? We've got close to anywhere from 1.5 to 2 million people. Some think in excess of 2 million. Because remember, the 660,550 was who? Fighting men 20 years old and above. So you got a lot under 20, and you've got many non-fighting men. Now let's quickly get the last verse, and we're done. The Lord met with Moses. Now, this is exactly what God said he would do. So let's mark, if you don't have it in the margin of your text, let's put Exodus 25, verses 21 and 22. Exodus 25, 21 and 22. This is where God said he would meet with him at the Ark of the Covenant. So Moses went into the tabernacle. So the tabernacle has been erected. We're back at Exodus 40. The tabernacle has been erected. And they brought all the sacrifice, they brought the carts, they're all ready for everything to go. And Moses goes in, and he heard a voice of one speaking, and the text says, from above the mercy seat. That's where man met with God. Hence the lid, the mercy seat. And from between the cherubim, thus he spoke to him. This is where man met with God. Make sense? This is where God communicated. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, now we're going to see what that's all about. But that's next week. Make sense? We're going to have to stop. That's 5 to 7.